Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thank you very much, Jared, and I particularly appreciate the very important role the Sydney Institute plays in public debate in this country. It's something that I think we all should acknowledge as a great contribution that we should have more of. I want to do something slightly unorthodox this evening and talk about how I feel. I do plenty of talking about how I think, there'll be a little bit of in this contribution this evening, but I also want to talk about how I feel and about something that over the years I've come to understand really means more to me as a Member of Parliament than pretty much anything else. After 10 years of defeat and despair, there's a simple question that we in the Labor Party can't avoid, and that is, what are we for? What is Labor for? What's our purpose, and what do we propose to do to fulfil that? All political movements exist for a reason. Sometimes they change because their reason for existence changes. Sometimes they die because their reason for existence disappears. The DLP suffered that. We're seeing the Australian Democrats suffer the same thing. Since 1996, Labor's spent a lot of time spinning our wheels. We've made great progress in the last year or so, but there's still a lot more to be done. And to me, the most important thing is that we have to further refine our core mission. What is it that we're about? Our founding purpose was to regulate the labour market. That's still central to our task, but it's now essentially a defensive purpose. We're protecting past achievements rather than building new ones. Now, since that first emergence of political labour in 1891, we've added new layers to our mission statement: public ownership, social security, universal health services, environmental sustainability. Each of these has driven, in turn, great labour achievements. And as purposes, they still drive modern labour to a significant extent. But they don't differentiate us from our opponents to anything like the degree that they once did. As I've heard many times while talking about the issue of Telstra, Labour primatised the Commonwealth Bank and Qantas. The Conservatives, to the surprise of some, have expanded the welfare state, and they now claim to be the best friends that Medicare ever had after John Howard went through an iteration where he was committed to destroying Medicare. So these points of difference are now more obvious to us than they are to the wider community. And we can't succeed just by defending our achievements of the past. We have to pursue big changes for the future. As a commentator called Tony Cutcliffe, who I know quite well, who recently published an article in the Canberra Times in which he described modern labour as, quote, a type of club whose purpose is to create powerful careers for its insiders while building a public face around celebrity, self-righteousness and puerile nationalism. He didn't pull any punches. Now, that's unfair, perhaps, but he does pose a challenge. If we aren't the bunch of cynical careerists in this caricature, then who are we? It's a legitimate question. Who are we? What does the light on the hill now consist of? Labour market regulation? Public ownership? Government services? Now, it's easy for us to respond with jargon and platitudes. Sure, we're in favour of outcomes like better living standards, greater opportunity, even ladders of opportunity. Who isn't? But we're more than just competent technocrats who manage the institutions of the state. We aim to be more than that. What is it that makes our vision for Australia's future fundamentally different from our political competitors? In my view, the need to answer that question and to have a clear, simple answer to that question is now becoming critical because politics is changing around us. If we don't adapt to the emerging world, then we'll be left behind. We're not the only party with this problem. In spite of winning, very impressively, a referendum on the Bush presidency a week or two ago, the US Democrats have got the very same problem. They still haven't really resolved what they're actually for. There are a couple of trends that are threatening parties like us and the Democrats around the world. The first is what I call entertainment politics. As the fault lines between left and right have blurred in societies like ours, politics has gradually drifted more and more into the world of entertainment. We now have celebrities becoming candidates and candidates becoming celebrities. Being famous for being famous is now an important qualification for political office. Party affiliation still does matter a bit, but parties now increasingly seek out celebrities as candidates. Aspiring leaders try to become celebrities and make themselves the issue. In the United States, which invariably is the leader in political trends, we've seen Jesse Ventura, a celebrity wrestler, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who were entertainers who became politicians. The forthcoming presidential contest in France, which fascinates me, is essentially shaping up as a contest between politicians who are becoming entertainers. Nicolas Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal. Ségolène Royal, there was a delightful quote in The Economist the other day, said very politely that she, quote, dwells little on specifics and a lot on style. Now, I have to tell you, that's an understatement. But Sarkozy is pretty much the same. He changes shape almost daily. Everyone knows who they are, but not much about what they stand for. New British Conservative leader David Cameron is pursuing the same strategy. A saviour is carefully marketed as different in some ways from ordinary politicians without actually standing for anything. His ideas are essentially marketing devices rather than serious policies. Now, the gradual decline of political intermediaries like trade unions, friendly societies, churches, service clubs has left the media as the unchallenged point of connection between ordinary citizens and the political process. And partly as a result of that, entertainment has taken over as the dominant factor in democratic politics. So why does this matter? Why does it matter to Labor? Because serious policies can be a little complex and boring. And if we are unable to express a central purpose that is clear and simple, a simple theme that says this is who we are and what we're about, then no matter how many worthy social democratic initiatives and programs we put forward, our program will drown in a sea of personality politics. Entertainment is in effect depoliticising politics. And in order to fight against that trend, we need cut-through content as a political movement. The second global trend that's threatening Labor is the growing divide between rationalists and traditionalists, something which I first wrote about in the Australian context 15 years ago, but has moved on a great deal since then. If you want to see the future of politics in developed societies, look at Eastern Europe. Because with the collapse of communism, you had the emergence of new political forces that weren't, in a sense, creatures of decades of history. And when you look at countries like Poland and Hungary, you see a very different configuration of forces. The new fault lines in those democracies are very different from what we're used to. The new divide is essentially between educated cosmopolitan urban dwellers and lower skilled urban and rural workers and pensioners. One group is socially left-wing and economically right-wing. The other is socially right-wing and economically left-wing. So we now have former communists who are enthusiastic pro-market modernisers, and the standard bearers of collectivism are often religious nationalists who in some cases are openly racist. Now, why does that matter to Australian Labor? Because although Australia as a society is different in many ways, the same pattern is here, and we've got a foot in both camps. John Howard's wedge politics strategy is built on this divide. And if we don't work out a way to conquer that, then it's going to conquer us. Managerial competence and political skills might enable us to prevail at the state level for some time, but something much more fundamental is needed nationally for us to succeed, and in particular, a core central theme that enables us to appeal across that divide is crucial. So precisely who are we? Over recent years, perhaps more than ever before, I've paid quite a bit of attention to this question and my own motivation. Why am I in this game? Why am I Labor? What am I on about? I've come to understand my core values as a person and as a politician probably much more clearly. And I've realised in doing that that there's a core thread running through Labor's tradition, a golden thread, that reflects my own outlook on life, a thread that's been there since the beginning, that's dominated our message in the modern era, and that really truly is at the heart of our mission. That golden thread is learning. To me, more than anything else, Labor stands for learning. The small country town that I grew up in far east Gippsland, didn't get TV until I was 10 years old. So I read books. That meant I was seen as a little bit strange, but nonetheless, I copped that. I read books. I had the misfortune to spend 6 years at a country boarding school, and I used to read books under the blankets after lights out with the aid of a rather dodgy torch. At university, I did more subjects than I needed to. I did a master's degree that I didn't need to do. I did a master's degree in history out of interest, out of passion. I've been learning Greek for many years. As Jared mentioned in the introduction, I've written several books. And more than anything else, the joy that I get out of being a Member of Parliament is about the learning that I can do, the incredible amount of diverse knowledge that as a Member of Parliament, whether through committees or dealing with issues or dealing with constituents or your own individual portfolio, the incredible amount of knowledge that you absorb and the ability to broaden your understanding of the world, I value enormously. To me, learning is a profoundly wonderful thing in its own right. Not just about making money. Making money is important. It's important to me. It's important to pretty well everybody. But you also learn because it makes you a better person. And part of my self-realisation about these things came from understanding my wider family background and some of the people in my family, that there is a common pattern there, that there is a deeply embedded set of values that says learning is important in its own right. So the reason I'm in the Labor Party ultimately is because that's where, in my view, the deepest commitment to learning can be found in Australian politics. The thing that makes me Labor is love of learning. Learning's been central to progressive politics in Australia from the very outset. The first Mechanics Institute was established in Hobart, interestingly enough, in 1827. In the 1870s and 1880s, working men's colleges were established around Australia. Workers' education associations were established in Australia in 1910, following their creation in Britain in 1902. And there were a variety of Marxist-oriented labour colleges and plebs leagues established in the various states in the 1920s. Commencing in 1872 in my own state of Victoria, the principle of free, compulsory and secular education was adopted in all the Australian colonies. Driven by crusading liberal politicians like Charles Pearson — my mum grew up in a street named after Charles Pearson in West Brunswick, so I'm pleased to see that. Driven by crusading politicians like Charles Pearson, this principle of free, compulsory, secular education was central to the emerging Australian nation. Paul Kelly, in that great book, The End of Certainty, identified the Australian settlement as consisting of white Australia, protectionism, wage arbitration, as he called it, or conciliation and arbitration, state paternalism, and imperial benevolence. In my view, he should have added free, compulsory and secular education to that list, because that principle was crucial to the creation of a distinctively Australian social framework and was self-consciously about universal access to learning and self-consciously about distinguishing Australia from old Europe in a variety of ways. Interestingly, the phrase free, compulsory and secular can be found in Labor Party national platforms nearly 100 years later. Such was the power of that concept. The commitment to learning that's embedded in these kind of initiatives, to be frank, came initially from progressive liberals, particularly in Victoria. But it soon became central to Labor's mission. It's interesting that our most famous icon is called the Tree of Knowledge. It's not called the Tree of Public Ownership. It's not the Tree of Labour Market Regulation, nor is it the Tree of Welfare. So even at the very outset, that sense of learning was very deeply embedded in Labor's culture, in our mission. Now, I have to admit that in the first half of the last century, Labor's commitment to learning was probably modest. The first federal political leader to promise federal funding for schools was Sir Robert Menzies in the latter war years when he was trying to rebuild the Liberal Party. John Curtin, then Prime Minister, rejected the idea. Labor didn't commit to that proposition until 1961. And Labor movement attitudes to learning in that time were probably a bit mixed. Many unionists disdained university education as the domain of the spoiled rich. And this attitude I experienced even in the 1970s and 1980s in the Victorian Labor Party, a bit of an ingrained or entrenched antagonism to universities, because that's basically where rich people went. However, the trade union movement was also a reflection of a very rich tradition of trade and technical learning, which later culminated in the sweeping reforms of the 1980s inspired by Laurie Carmichael and the ACTU. And the tradition of learning and of pride in craft, pride in technical capability, pride in trade, was very much an important component of militant trade unionism in Australia. Everybody knows the broad story of John Halfpenny, one of the most militant and most notorious and most famous of Australia's trade union leaders. What many people don't know is that John Halfpenny's youth was also Victorian Apprentice of the Year. So there's a deep thread of commitment to craft and to learning in the tradition of militant trade unionism and labourism in this country as well. Since that period of the 50s and 60s, the commitment to learning, I'd argue, has gradually become the core theme in Labor's belief system. The Whitlam government was defined more by its education initiatives, like the Schools Commission and free university tuition, than any other policy. The only contender for that crown other than its education initiatives would, of course, be Medibank. In his 1974 election campaign speech, Whitlam described the Schools Commission as the greatest single achievement of our government. The background work on this policy began as early as 1964. Since then, learning has been right at the heart of Labor's message. If you think about the Hawke Keating era, think of the massive expansion of university education, the creation of cooperative research centres, the training guarantee levy, the development of competency-based training that I referred to before, the establishment of the Australian National Training Authority, labour market programs under Working Nation with a mutual obligation component inevitably about training and learning, massive increases and improvements in school retention rates, the Clever Country. So many big things happened in the Hawke Keating era that we tend to overlook the lasting importance of learning as a central thread that runs through the entire period of that government. And since we lost office, it's become even more crucial. Think of Kim Beazley's Knowledge Nation policy, much derided, but in content exactly the kind of thing that this nation required. Mark Latham's Learning and Earning Strategy for Young Australians, Kim Beazley's recent Skills in Schools blueprint, and University's White Paper, which I would argue is probably the most important and substantial piece of serious policy work done on either side of politics in the past decade in this country. Kim Beazley says often that he wants to be Labor's Education Prime Minister. The education and training portfolio is held by our Deputy Leader, Jenny Macklin. Over the past couple of years, we have produced more substantial policy in this area than in any other. Steve Brax, at the state level, describes education as his government's number one priority, and you'll hear similar sentiments expressed in various other parts of the country. Craig Emerson, who's made a name for himself on the backbench as a very vigorous and radical policy thinker, is promoting radical reform proposals that are really built on a single premise, that learning is the key to better social and economic outcomes. And how often have we heard Labor leaders use the phrase education, education, education? Labor's commitment to learning can also be seen locally, and I want to cite a specific example of this that I find personally very inspiring. The city of Hume has established a global learning village in Broadmeadows, which is a very disadvantaged part of the northern suburbs of Melbourne. A major learning hub, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year financing from the local council, the city of Hume, that offers library resources and a whole variety of courses, dozens and dozens of courses for local residents, with assistance from private donors like Visy and Ford and The Age. The village also offers a prize annually to one child in year four in every primary school in the city of Hume. That's 44 primary schools. They offer a computer as a prize that they call a Love of Learning prize. And the whole idea is to promote commitment to learning through this prize. The village funds and operates a Celebration of Learning festival, and its literature states very overtly that it aims to get people, quote, to embrace learning as a way of life. I'm proud of the fact that Labor councillors have been at the forefront of this commitment. Others, like Frank Maguire, also deserve great credit, but former Mayor Gary Jungwirth has played a leading role. His passion for creating learning opportunities in one of Melbourne's most disadvantaged areas, in my mind, makes him a true Labor hero, though people outside of his own backyard would probably not have heard of him. He is somebody who is living out in his commitment in local government what I see as the core ethos that drives Labor. Now, it's important to point out that learning is much wider than education. It's not just a skills issue, it's not just a productivity issue or an economic inputs issue. To me, it's a values issue. Learning increases opportunity, it enables participation, it opens hearts and minds. It is about values as much as it's about economics. It's at the heart of debates about childcare, preschool, schools, universities, TAFE, apprenticeships, obviously, labour market programs, neighbourhood houses, welfare, immigration, aged care even. It helps deliver better social and economic outcomes, better health outcomes, like alleviating loneliness and dementia, or delaying the onset of dementia. The Smith family even defines learning as, and again I quote from a letter to the Financial Review recently, the foundation for helping disadvantaged children to break free from the spiral of poverty. Here's a simple question. If there were no skills crisis, would Labor still be passionately committed to expanding our nation's investment in learning? You bet we would. You bet we would. The passion in that commitment defines the kind of society that we want to create. It reflects our core values, it reflects my core values, not just a prescription for better economic outcomes. Learning is about discovery, it's about building a better world. Now, this commitment to learning now matters more than ever. Why? Because under John Howard, the Liberal Party has gradually morphed into an anti-learning party, seeking to exploit the disdain for learning that is inherent, I think, in the Australian culture. What makes you angry tells you a lot about your personal belief system. Denigration of learning has been a persistent theme in the Howard government's message over the years. And over that past 10 years, I can't think of anything that's made me angrier than the regular undermining of learning values. We're one of the few countries in the world where the term academic is a term of derision. We worship sports people and we ignore intellectual achievers. We revere the practical and the physical, and we barely tolerate the cerebral. Now, in the 1950s and 1960s, that probably didn't matter that much because national development was heavily focused on digging mines, building dams, grazing sheep, and a highly protected and very inefficient manufacturing industry with a lot of basically very low-skilled jobs. It didn't really matter that our levels of education achievement were well below those of similar countries. It sure matters now. I recently reread Donald Horne's famous book, The Lucky Country, and it was very scary because so little has changed. More than four decades later, his basic critique still rings fairly true. Phrases like triumphant mediocrity, cleverness can be considered un-Australian, and a nation more concerned with styles of life than with achievement haven't lost their bite. Now, talking of things that make you angry, a few months ago, Shane Warne, who's a very good cricketer, was awarded an honorary doctorate in business administration, of all things, on his birthday. Happy birthday, Shane. By Southampton Solent University. Now, I think David Beckham's also got a degree from them as well. They're into this kind of thing. And we'll leave the university for another time. But to the Australian media, this was all a bit of a hoot. Warren decked out there with the academic gown and the funny hat and all that kind of stuff was a great photo opportunity. It just made me angry. Sure, it was an English university performing this outrageous parody, but the message was really clear. Higher learning is all a bit of a laugh. Funny people in funny hats. Good old fair dinkum Aussie blokes don't do this sort of stuff, do they? That was the real message of that performance. Now, having somebody like Warren, who's notorious for his lack of interest in learning at school, parading around like some kind of pantomime horse in an academic outfit, to me was very sad. Nobody else really seemed to notice or to care. Now, to me, this nonsense is roughly equivalent to inducting John Howard into the Australian Cricket Hall of Fame for that infamous bowling performance he managed in Kashmir when he dropped the ball on his toe. That's broadly the equivalent. Now, I'm a serious cricket fan, like many other Australians, but I'm also passionate about learning. In fact, I'm more passionate about learning. And when sporting celebrities proudly announce they've never read a book, they're telling young Australians that learning is for nerds. Learning's for nerds. That's the real message. Now, underneath John Howard's glib phrases, what we really have is an unrelenting assault on Australian learning. The party of learning under Menzies has become the party of ignorance under Howard. Few remember that when Howard lost the leadership to Andrew Peacock in 1989, Peacock offered him the shadow Ministry of Education, and he rejected that because it wasn't an important enough portfolio. He hasn't changed. Last year he observed that leaving school early was fine if you're not academically inclined. His former Education Minister, Brendan Nelson, constantly sought to inflame resentment against universities amongst non-tertiary educated workers and suggested that creationism ought to be taught in schools. His current Education Minister claims that Maoists are writing school curriculums, tries to ban serious books on terrorism, and demands that the states should step up to the plate and start contributing to the funding of Australian universities after the Commonwealth under Howard has very dramatically reduced funding to universities. His Vocational Education and Training Minister is grinding industry skills councils into the ground. And few will remember this, but I certainly remember it. When I published a book about Australia's future called Open Australia, Peter Costello did one of those famous theatrical performances in Question Time where he quipped that Labor was becoming a book club. Again, underneath this, what do you see? Contempt for learning. It's at the core of the modern Liberal Party. And in an era when education and training are more crucial than ever before, the Howard government's performance on these issues is simply scandalous. Simply scandalous. Our school completion rates are way below OECD averages. In 2005, a staggering 46% of school leavers were not enrolled in any form of post-school education. Our average education levels are significantly below those in comparable countries at all age cohorts. A recent OECD study of 20 developed countries found that we spend the lowest amount on preschool education of any of the 20 countries. Since 1995, this is a famous figure, a well-known figure, Australian government spending on higher education and training, essentially university and TAFE, has fallen by 7%, while the OECD average has increased by 48%. Bob Birrell, not a bloke I always agree with, I'd have to say, nailed this a few weeks ago when he said, far too many young people are not being equipped for a labour market increasingly demanding technical, analytical and managerial skills. This lack of commitment to learning entrenches poverty and disadvantage because early school leavers have much higher unemployment rates and much bleaker prospects in life. Now, juxtaposed against that record is an interesting fiscal record, something as Shadow Finance Minister I'm very conscious of. Between December last year and May this year, government estimates of revenue for this financial year and the next two financial years were upgraded. A bit more money coming in the door than they thought, to the tune of $42 billion. $42 billion more in government revenue over those 3 years was the estimate in May this year as compared with December last year. Now, they've spent a lot, as you'd expect, either in tax cuts or spending. $42 billion, actually they've spent slightly more, 43 point something. Barely more than 1% of that enormous windfall has been dedicated to additional expenditure in education and training. Barely more than 1%. Slightly higher than has been dedicated to new spending in agriculture, fisheries and forestry. The real message of this is very clear. Ignorance is bliss. That's the real slogan on which the Howard government operates. I want Australia to be a country that values learning above all other things. In John Howard's Australia, it's an afterthought. But, to be fair to him, we shouldn't imagine it's all his fault. It's not. He's simply exploiting and magnifying social prejudice that is deeply ingrained in our culture. Our indifferent attitude to learning isn't just the fault of governments, it's also the fault of parents. Too many Australians regard schools as essentially glorified child mining centres and don't take much interest in what goes on inside them. Too many are ready to attack teachers and governments for all kinds of failings, but don't take enough responsibility for their kids' commitment to learning. The more contact I have with different schools, the more I'm convinced that the hidden factor in school performance is parental aspiration. Resources are obviously crucial, but attitudes to learning in the family environment are also vital. The passive welfare model of education, which is essentially what we've traditionally had in this country, understates the crucial importance of aspiration. Lack of achievement will often be a product of lack of expectation. If a child grows up in an environment where learning isn't valued, he or she is less likely to succeed in learning and less likely to succeed in life. That's why the Global Learning Village is so important. It seeks to change attitudes to learning in schools, in communities, in families, and that's why Howard's messages are so damaging. If our nation's government doesn't care about learning, why should its citizens? Why should its parents? The she'll be right mentality is an enduring part of our culture, and in certain respects a very positive thing. But part of it is an ingrained hostility to learning. It's fading, thankfully, I have to concede, because parents more and more are starting to realise that skills are crucial to their kids' futures, but it's still strong nevertheless. Young people who want to learn are always more likely to succeed at school and at work. Wouldn't it be great if Australia had a Prime Minister who was dedicated to promoting learning rather than attacking it? To me, commitment to learning is the key to individual and national success. It's being undermined by conservative politicians who are stoking popular prejudice. It's also, I would have to admit, being undermined by things like postmodernist theories. When leading educators argue that learning history is no more important than learning tapestry, something is seriously wrong. The Canberra Times in an article only a couple of weeks ago. If everything is considered equally valid, what's the point of learning anything? Learning doesn't only happen in education institutions. It's not just something that goes on in lecture theatres or laboratories. It's not just for academic types in classrooms. It happens at childcare. It happens in community groups. It happens on the job. Many blue-collar workers lament the demise of serious learning and training in their chosen trades. Talk to a Telstra technician, and you won't have to talk for very long to hear the sad story of the dramatic decline in training and learning within Telstra, the ever-growing outsourcing of skilled activities to people who don't have the same skill levels, and the early stages of what is inevitably going to be a skills crisis in that technical area, along with many others, because of the fact that we've got a huge bulge of people in their late 40s and their 50s who are the primary skilled people. A lot of skilled blue-collar workers have a very strong sense of pride in their craft, in their trade, in learning in their area, and that's why learning is crucial as an underlying value, not just for the kind of learning that I engage in as a young person, but right across the board, be it academic or technical. And our need for skilled technical workers has never been greater, and yet somehow we've managed to alienate countless young people from learning through an excessive focus on university entrance in schools. We've effectively increased the barriers. Labor is thankfully committed to fixing this problem. Kim Beazley's plan for specialist senior technical schools, I think, will make a big difference. In a world where our skills are our best safety net, we cannot afford to push young people away from learning. So in conclusion, we've got, I think, a very big task in front of us. We have to change Australian attitudes to learning. We don't just want to change funding. We don't just want to change curriculum. We don't just want to change structures. We have to change attitudes as well. Let's resolve the endless state-federal disputes, public-private disputes, academic-technical arguments. Let's commit ourselves to greater investment in learning across the board. For Australia to compete in a changing world, we have to become a learning society. Labor's primary goal isn't extending public ownership. There's a statement of the obvious for you. It isn't extending the welfare state. That's a statement of the almost obvious. It's not even extending labour market regulation, notwithstanding the life and death battle that's going on about work choices. Our primary goal is to extend access to learning, to ensure everyone can live full, good lives and participate fully in our society. One of the things that I've worked out over the years is that pretty well everybody's good at something. And part of the trick about running a decent society is to ensure that everybody has got the ability to pursue that thing that they're good at and to be valued for it, to make a contribution to the society. We have to ensure that everybody can turn that ability into a worthwhile contribution and be rewarded for it. Learning changes lives. It's the key to a better future for our kids, and it's a key to the better future for our country. We need more investment in learning. We need a much stronger commitment to the ethos of learning. And most importantly of all, we have to abandon that lingering culture of mediocrity and ignorance. It could be amusing to some. No doubt plenty of people laughed when they saw Shane Warne in his funny outfit. It might be amusing to some, but it's dragging us down. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that. I should say thanks to Mr. Ellison for the use of this facility tonight and for Mr.'s hospitality. Much appreciated. So we come to questions and discussion. We have till 7 o'clock, and if we run out of questions, we've never had this before, actually, but I got a question via text message today. It's from a person called Dr. Warning, so if we run out, I've got one here.
His question is, who's Lindsay?
Okay, now we don't have a lot. We've got to be brief with our questions. Yes.
Can you explain what the white paper about universities is that you mentioned, and does Labor have any plans to get back to the good old days when they had enough money to run their operations?
Certainly we do, although the question of how much that amount might ultimately involve is obviously a matter yet to be finally determined. But certainly there's a commitment to increase the funding to universities, as there was has been at previous elections. There's a number of themes in that white paper. One is to move away from the one-size-fits-all, highly micro-regulated university and allow a greater internal market within the university sector, so allow a greater freedom for universities to make choices about how they offer, what they offer, how they offer it. So I think that's quite an important thing. Secondly, there's a strong recognition that we are under threat on the quality front, and a proposal to establish a quality agency that is there as a reference point. There's been some significant concerns about the tendency for some universities to lower quality in order to maximise their overseas students' input, which is in turn being driven by the funding starvation problem. So that's another proposal in that paper. Thirdly, of course, the need to alleviate the HECS burden, specifically in certain areas where Australia is not attracting as many students as we should, in areas like mathematics and science and some of the technical disciplines. So there's proposals around those issues. There are proposals about funding generally and the approach that should be taken, in which it's implicit that we do increase funding to universities. Now, there's a number of other things in the paper. I can't rattle them all off the top of my head, but it's actually about 100 pages. But it's quite well written, so it's readable. But for those who are specifically interested in higher education policy, I would very strongly urge you to read it and give us feedback on it, because a lot of work, a lot of thought has gone into that paper.
I don't entirely agree with you that the anti-intellectualism and anti-academic feeling is rife in Australia. But how exactly would a government go about changing that sort of attitude if it's entrenched in culture?
Look, I think what politicians say, particularly prime ministers, is enormously influential, and what they legitimise and what they don't legitimise is enormously influential. That's why, even though strictly speaking, when John Howard says it's fine to leave school early, strictly speaking, what he was saying was it's fine to leave school early and go on to an apprenticeship or a trade and whatever. But in reality, the message that was conveyed was it's fine to leave school early, and for those of you who've done it well, you know, it's no big deal, and so on. So wider messages to the community, I think, matter a lot. And I'm talking from personal experience here. My family were classic inner Melbourne, sort of working class origin, one Protestant, one Catholic couple who moved to the bush. They sort of came into, you know, I was born in the mid-50s, they came into their kind of period of sort of following politics, I suppose, the height of the Menzies era. And they absorbed, like countless other people, a really strong message in the 1950s, and that was education is crucial. Education is crucial. And I don't think there's any doubt that the ultimate source of that sentiment was the Prime Minister. For whatever reason, and we have many gripes with Menzies on many fronts, but from my personal background, my personal experience, I give him credit for setting a tone in public life in the 1950s on this issue that said learning's important, because my parents absorbed it, and they absorbed it from other sources as well, and I ultimately benefited from that. So I think wider messages really important. And how often do you hear John Howard actually talking up learning and the value of universities and the value of training and all those things? You don't, because he's starving them money. You know, I think he understands that he'd look a bit ridiculous. So,
I'll stop you in the Victorian working class story. I came up in a similar background, but my Protestant mother that became Catholic married my Catholic father, and I went off to the 2 and 6 a week Catholic school. I agree with you, it was an era of learning and all the rest of it, but that was our only way up. But we've gone through a period now of 30 years of taking university education free, as it once was, for granted. And I just wonder to what extent our public and secular education system and our free university system isn't to some extent responsible for this backlash or getting back to some more pragmatic utilitarian idea about the worth of whatever you train to do. And it's interesting that while you talk about, you know, the lowest common denominator attitude to learning, we've also got a situation now where there's a sort of two-track education, where we've got private schools becoming more and more popular, and this is not John Howard. And we've got Canberra with the highest percentage of children going to private schools, which is, you know, one of the most Labour-leading electorates. So to what extent do you think we've just had too many decades of taking education in a welfare sense for granted, and that we really need Labour included, a whole new idea about what we mean by education?
Look, I think that's a valid point. And I think one of the things we don't understand is wider social and economic change, so that people often criticise the baby boomers and say, oh, it's fine for you, you know, you had free university education and we don't. Well, yeah, about 10% of them did. Pity about the other 90% who didn't go to university. I was part of a very small group. And, of course, there's been a massive expansion in university education, so in the equivalent cohort now, it's probably about 35-40% going to university. And the crucial thing about private schools, where I think I'd be in agreement with the underlying point, what you're saying, what's more than anything else driven the drift to private schools is affluence. The percentage of the population, with or without government subsidies, who can afford to send their kids to private schools has soared, because the relative standard of living of the vast bulk of Australians now compared with 50 years ago is much greater. In real terms, our incomes, our average incomes, are roughly treble what they were 50 years ago. And inevitably what that means is that just as people are buying jet skis and plasma TVs and overseas trips, that a lot of people are actually choosing to invest in their kids' education. Now, is that a bad thing? Of course it's not. Of course it's not. And one of the things that I want to see Labor unhooked from is this kind of internal public versus private debate. We have got a primary responsibility as government to the government education system, but that doesn't mean that we should be denigrating private education. As far as I'm concerned, people who want to spend money on educating their children rather than taking some overseas cruise or putting a swimming pool in the backyard, good on them. If they've got that kind of disposable income, and yes, there's debates about government money and how that should be allocated, and yes, we are firmly committed to the needs principle as the bedrock of how that's done. But don't for a moment denigrate people for sending their kids to private schools. You know, like, if that's ultimately driven more than anything else by affluence. Now, I'm strongly committed to the public school system and building up our investment in that system and improving the system, but to me it doesn't advantage anybody to do that as some kind of public versus private debate. I think we've got to move beyond that.
Yes, you talked about the what I might call the duck showing and finger pointing between the federal and state governments over education. So that's something that needs to be addressed. How will you address it?
In a sense, there's a question still to be answered there, and of course I'm not the person specifically in charge of these policy areas, but I'll tell you one thing that we definitely won't do is the kind of opportunistic cherry-picking style of approach that the Howard government has done, whether it's about flagpoles or about report cards or whatever. The one thing John Howard will never do about schools is take responsibility. He'll never take responsibility. There's all these little interventions that are designed to play a political card and to tweak a populist nerve somewhere in the electorate while always maintaining the ability to blame the states for the wider outcomes. Now, that's one thing I'm certainly not going to get into, and I'm absolutely convinced Jenny Macklin, Kim Beazley are not going to get into. So, yes, there is a question there. I think we will approach that in a sense of cooperation, seeking to establish an intelligent distribution of responsibilities between Commonwealth and states. But, as your question implies, we have yet to set out a specific proposition along those lines. And in some respects, it's not easy to do that from opposition. It's hard to negotiate with sovereign governments, even though they're of the same political colour as us, when you're not a sovereign government yourself, about such fundamental issues.
Chris Drummond.
Lindsay, you mentioned that you brought up in Victoria and you read books. This was prior to TV. Now children have not only TV, pay TV, iPods, laptops...
PSPs.
The issue is, I suppose, the internet. I'm interested in your view on whether the internet as a resource is an opportunity or a threat to learning. There's opportunities for plagiarism, there's opportunities for now. Do you need institutions anymore because you've got an online functionality where you can do it directly and get the resource rather than having to attend an institution?
Look, I think ultimately it's a profoundly positive development, but it does have some negative characteristics that, like any new technology, you need to be conscious of and you need to minimise. To me, the best historical parallel with the emergence of the internet is the invention of printing. That's the best parallel that I can think of. So, for example, did printing destroy face-to-face learning? No, it didn't. So did classrooms and tutorials and word-of-mouth-based learning disappear as a result of the invention of printing? No, it didn't. What happened was that a new delivery mechanism with vastly greater reach and capability was created, and it added to the existing mechanisms. And I think that's essentially what the internet's doing as well. There are one or two areas that you are right to perhaps have some concern about, but in overall terms I think it's a profoundly positive thing, and it's a profoundly democratic thing as well. The fact that it's harder for governments to tell you, you know, what to learn or to tell you that, you know, you're on this topic, you're allowed to look at these things but not those things. I think that's broadly a very positive thing. I think the Wikipedia is fantastic. The idea that you have this kind of constantly evolving, argued about detailed knowledge that people are contributing to on a daily basis, and that people like me can just access about some of the most obscure things imaginable, to me that's fantastic.
You in it?
I suspect I probably am, but I haven't looked. Well, maybe I should.
Must have a look.
Yeah. I better check. There could be all sorts of horrible things about me.
Me too.
Well, I think the Debbie Glenn was being argued over in the Wikipedia, wasn't she?
Yeah.
To what extent does the policy document extend the love of learning into later life? And you know, is this an area of emphasis to improve the quality of life and longevity as well?
I mentioned this in passing in my speech. I think it's very important. I've had relatives who've been involved in the University of the Third Age, for example. My former headmaster from school, who must be seriously aged by now, but exactly the same as he was, you know, 30-odd years ago, and somebody I respect and admire enormously. When I caught up with him a couple of years ago, he was teaching history courses at a University of the Third Age down in the peninsula. I've got a University of the Third Age that's established in my electorate that I helped to launch. That's a really worthwhile thing. I think the extent to which we assist mature age people to develop new skills and to extend or improve their employability is still very, very modest in this country. I've had an ongoing email exchange with this bloke who has had various work in technical areas of graphic design and various other things for a number of years. He's in his mid-30s. He's got no formal qualifications. He's unemployed. He's actually got a range of genuine skills, and he's desperate to get an adult apprenticeship, but he needs some kind of serious income support because he can't, you know, suddenly go to $7 an hour or whatever it is, and he's really struggling. So there's some really important things I think we need to do in that area. And I think it's been fairly well established that learning, whether it's learning a musical instrument or learning a language or whatever, or just engaging your brain, does actually delay the onset of dementia. Now, that's kind of a pretty serious issue in the modern world. My mother-in-law's got Alzheimer's. I've got two other close relatives with Alzheimer's, and the numbers on the percentage or the raw numbers of people who are going to have dementia as our population ages is quite frightening. So the more we can ward that off, that's a serious objective of social policy.
Just go 1, 2, 3,
that'll
be brief. Yep.
Okay.
Do you think Dawkins really has established allowed too many universities in Australia, and we have to now go to say towards an American system where you have a small number of high class universities that are very hard, very competitive, very hard to get in with, and the others are the also rats?
Look, I wouldn't necessarily put it that way, but I think there's the case for the Dawkins model of that uniform, you know, 35 or 38 or whatever it was, institutions all essentially seeking to be pretty much the same thing. I think the critique of that is correct, although the underlying rationale for it was compelling. I wouldn't necessarily describe it in the way you've described it, but I think the theme of Jenny Macklin's university's paper is to allow some internal market forces to produce some differentiation there, to make sure that you've got core funding that enables regionally based universities to survive, but provided that they actually, in a sense, follow the market and don't try to turn themselves into things that realistically they're not going to be. I strongly support the thrust of that, but I think there's some more debate to be had on that question.
Yes, I'm encouraged to feel that you're doing a step up from mere navel-gazing to deeper soul-searching, but yet, was it not a Labor Party that made universities not free anymore? In other words, it started that, and that could possibly have begun the lowering of intellectual quality through the years in between.
the first part of your question, that's certainly true. And I opposed, I was the union secretary at the time, the introduction of HECS. I opposed it. I was wrong. And I've actually admitted that numerous times publicly for quite a number of years now. What I didn't realise, what I didn't understand at the time, was that the choice the Hawke government was making was to massively expand the system and to massively expand the number of young Australians able to undertake higher education, and the price for doing that was to require them to contribute something in the fairest way that was able to be dreamed up to the cost of doing that. So in a sense, they made a choice that said, we no longer need a Rolls-Royce system for a relatively small group of people, as prevailed in the 70s when I was at university. Our society needs a much larger number of people to undertake higher education, but both for fiscal reasons and for equity reasons, they should make a contribution. I opposed it at the time. I'm happy to admit I was wrong. Whether this made a whether this has contributed to a denigration of learning or undermining of learning, look, in certain specific small respects, possibly yes. So underfunding of universities and overcrowding and some of the more dubious practices associated with maximising overseas student intakes by some universities, undermining of quality, I suspect on the margins that's probably true and therefore worthy of being addressed. I would say to you that I think Jenny Macklin's paper about universities does actually take those issues into account. The time will tell whether we reverse those trends, but I wouldn't say they're big factors, but I'd concede that, yeah, they are factors.
Final question down the back, yeah.
The term learning, as you've described, it seems to cover both education and research. That seems to be politically much harder to sell funding of research than just funding of education. If you say we're going to increase the funding of education by universities, it might be easy to sell, but it's much harder to sell the idea of funding research projects. But from a productivity perspective, we need to increase funding for research as well. How do you overcome that?
Look, that's a fair point. We have, it's an interesting kind of internal discussion within Labor over the years that we have at various times made promises to significantly increase funding for research generally, both universities, CSIRO, research and development tax concession, cooperative research centres. And some would argue that the political flow on from that has been modest and that there's not many people out there voting one way or the other on those issues. I think it's more complicated than that, but I actually think ultimately the thing that matters in politics is a sense in the community that you've got a vision for the future of the nation that you're committed to, you believe in, and that has got some kind of coherence and that is not obviously stupid. That's a very important thing. It's a very important thing. And that even the components of that that may not in themselves excite a lot of people can nonetheless be very powerful components of a wider picture. So I think it's probably true to say that by itself, a funding commitment to research is not the kind of thing that's going to be front and centre in a big election campaign and that's going to swing hundreds of thousands of votes one way or the other. I think that's probably true. But as a component of a broader picture, I wouldn't necessarily say the same thing. So I'd say it's an important part of a bigger picture without necessarily providing you with a big bang all by itself. And to me, what is most important here is that we are rightly attacking John Howard's vision for the future of Australia, which is essentially work choices. But we have to juxtapose against that our alternative vision for the future of Australia, and I think things like research are a pretty important part of that. But if we allow it to be broken down to the different components and each of them to be judged individually in isolation, then some of them probably won't meet much of a political test, whereas I think collectively, if we get it right, then we'll have an uplifting, positive message that's a practical message about building a better country that will make work choices look the tawdry, unfair, extreme proposition that it is, even more than it already does.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thanks, John.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon. Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thank you very much, Jared, and I particularly appreciate the very important role the Sydney Institute plays in public debate in this country. It's something that I think we all should acknowledge as a great contribution that we should have more of. I want to do something slightly unorthodox this evening and talk about how I feel. I do plenty of talking about how I think, there'll be a little bit of in this contribution this evening, but I also want to talk about how I feel and about something that over the years I've come to understand really means more to me as a Member of Parliament than pretty much anything else. After 10 years of defeat and despair, there's a simple question that we in the Labor Party can't avoid, and that is, what are we for? What is Labor for? What's our purpose, and what do we propose to do to fulfil that? All political movements exist for a reason. Sometimes they change because their reason for existence changes. Sometimes they die because their reason for existence disappears. The DLP suffered that. We're seeing the Australian Democrats suffer the same thing. Since 1996, Labor's spent a lot of time spinning our wheels. We've made great progress in the last year or so, but there's still a lot more to be done. And to me, the most important thing is that we have to further refine our core mission. What is it that we're about? Our founding purpose was to regulate the labour market. That's still central to our task, but it's now essentially a defensive purpose. We're protecting past achievements rather than building new ones. Now, since that first emergence of political labour in 1891, we've added new layers to our mission statement: public ownership, social security, universal health services, environmental sustainability. Each of these has driven, in turn, great labour achievements. And as purposes, they still drive modern labour to a significant extent. But they don't differentiate us from our opponents to anything like the degree that they once did. As I've heard many times while talking about the issue of Telstra, Labour primatised the Commonwealth Bank and Qantas. The Conservatives, to the surprise of some, have expanded the welfare state, and they now claim to be the best friends that Medicare ever had after John Howard went through an iteration where he was committed to destroying Medicare. So these points of difference are now more obvious to us than they are to the wider community. And we can't succeed just by defending our achievements of the past. We have to pursue big changes for the future. There's a commentator called Tony Cutcliffe, who I know quite well, who recently published an article in the Canberra Times in which he described modern labour as, quote, a type of club whose purpose is to create powerful careers for its insiders while building a public face around celebrity, self-righteousness and puerile nationalism. He didn't pull any punches. Now, that's unfair, perhaps, but he does pose a challenge. If we aren't the bunch of cynical careerists in this caricature, then who are we? It's a legitimate question. Who are we? What does the light on the hill now consist of? Labour market regulation? Public ownership? Government services? Now, it's easy for us to respond with jargon and platitudes. Sure, we're in favour of outcomes like better living standards, greater opportunity, even ladders of opportunity. Who isn't? But we're more than just competent technocrats who manage the institutions of the state. We aim to be more than that. What is it that makes our vision for Australia's future fundamentally different from our political competitors? In my view, the need to answer that question and to have a clear, simple answer to that question is now becoming critical because politics is changing around us. If we don't adapt to the emerging world, then we'll be left behind. We're not the only party with this problem. In spite of winning very impressively a referendum on the Bush presidency a week or two ago, the US Democrats have got the very same problem. They still haven't really resolved what they're actually for. There are a couple of trends that are threatening parties like us and the Democrats around the world. The first is what I call entertainment politics. As the fault lines between left and right have blurred in societies like ours, politics has gradually drifted more and more into the world of entertainment. We now have celebrities becoming candidates and candidates becoming celebrities. Being famous for being famous is now an important qualification for political office. Party affiliation still does matter a bit, but parties now increasingly seek out celebrities as candidates. Aspiring leaders try to become celebrities and make themselves the issue. In the United States, which invariably is the leader in political trends, we've seen Jesse Ventura, a celebrity wrestler, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who were entertainers who became politicians. The forthcoming presidential contest in France, which fascinates me, is essentially shaping up as a contest between politicians who are becoming entertainers. Nicolas Sarkozy and Ségolène Royal. Ségolène Royal, there was a delightful quote in The Economist the other day, said very politely that she, quote, dwells little on specifics and a lot on style. Now, I have to tell you, that's an understatement. But Sarkozy is pretty much the same. He changes shape almost daily. Everyone knows who they are, but not much about what they stand for. New British Conservative leader David Cameron is pursuing the same strategy. A saviour is carefully marketed as different in some ways from ordinary politicians without actually standing for anything. His ideas are essentially marketing devices rather than serious policies. Now, the gradual decline of political intermediaries like trade unions, friendly societies, churches, service clubs has left the media as the unchallenged point of connection between ordinary citizens and the political process. And partly as a result of that, entertainment has taken over as the dominant factor in democratic politics. So why does this matter? Why does it matter to Labor? Because serious policies can be a little complex and boring. And if we are unable to express a central purpose that is clear and simple, a simple theme that says this is who we are and what we're about, then no matter how many worthy social democratic initiatives and programs we put forward, our program will drown in a sea of personality politics. Entertainment is in effect depoliticising politics. And in order to fight against that trend, we need cut-through content as a political movement. The second global trend that's threatening Labor is the growing divide between rationalists and traditionalists, something which I first wrote about in the Australian context 15 years ago, but has moved on a great deal since then. If you want to see the future of politics in developed societies, look at Eastern Europe. Because with the collapse of communism, you had the emergence of new political forces that weren't, in a sense, creatures of decades of history. And when you look at countries like Poland and Hungary, you see a very different configuration of forces. The new fault lines in those democracies are very different from what we're used to. The new divide is essentially between educated cosmopolitan urban dwellers and lower skilled urban and rural workers and pensioners. One group is socially left-wing and economically right-wing. The other is socially right-wing and economically left-wing. So we now have former communists who are enthusiastic pro-market modernisers, and the standard bearers of collectivism are often religious nationalists who in some cases are openly racist. Now, why does that matter to Australian Labor? Because although Australia as a society is different in many ways, the same pattern is here, and we've got a foot in both camps. John Howard's wedge politics strategy is built on this divide. And if we don't work out a way to conquer that, then it's going to conquer us. Managerial competence and political skills might enable us to prevail at the state level for some time, but something much more fundamental is needed nationally for us to succeed, and in particular, a core central theme that enables us to appeal across that divide is crucial. So precisely who are we? Over recent years, perhaps more than ever before, I've paid quite a bit of attention to this question and my own motivation. Why am I in this game? Why am I Labor? What am I on about? I've come to understand my core values as a person and as a politician probably much more clearly. And I've realised in doing that that there's a core thread running through Labor's tradition, a golden thread, that reflects my own outlook on life, a thread that's been there since the beginning, that's dominated our message in the modern era, and that really truly is at the heart of our mission. That golden thread is learning. To me, more than anything else, Labor stands for learning. The small country town that I grew up in far east Gippsland, didn't get TV until I was 10 years old. So I read books. That meant I was seen as a little bit strange, but nonetheless, I copped that. I read books. I had the misfortune to spend 6 years at a country boarding school, and I used to read books under the blankets after lights out with the aid of a rather dodgy torch. At university, I did more subjects than I needed to. I did a master's degree that I didn't need to do. I did a master's degree in history out of interest, out of passion. I've been learning Greek for many years. As Jared mentioned in the introduction, I've written several books. And more than anything else, the joy that I get out of being a Member of Parliament is about the learning that I can do, the incredible amount of diverse knowledge that as a Member of Parliament, whether through committees or dealing with issues or dealing with constituents or your own individual portfolio, the incredible amount of knowledge that you absorb and that the ability to broaden your understanding of the world, I value enormously. To me, learning is a profoundly wonderful thing in its own right. Not just about making money. Making money is important. It's important to me. It's important to pretty well everybody. But you also learn because it makes you a better person. And part of my self-realisation about these things came from understanding my wider family background and some of the people in my family, that there is a common pattern there, that there is a deeply embedded set of values that says learning is important in its own right. So the reason I'm in the Labor Party ultimately is because that's where, in my view, the deepest commitment to learning can be found in Australian politics. The thing that makes me Labor is love of learning. Learning's been central to progressive politics in Australia from the very outset. The first Mechanics Institute was established in Hobart, interestingly enough, in 1827. In the 1870s and 1880s, working men's colleges were established around Australia. Workers' education associations were established in Australia in 1910, following their creation in Britain in 1902. And there were a variety of Marxist-oriented labour colleges and plebs leagues established in the various states in the 1920s. Commencing in 1872 in my own state of Victoria, the principle of free, compulsory and secular education was adopted in all the Australian colonies. Driven by crusading liberal politicians like Charles Pearson — my mum grew up in a street named after Charles Pearson in West Brunswick, so I'm pleased to see that. Driven by crusading politicians like Charles Pearson, this principle of free, compulsory, secular education was central to the emerging Australian nation. Paul Kelly, in that great book, The End of Certainty, identified the Australian settlement as consisting of white Australia, protectionism, wage arbitration, as he called it, or conciliation and arbitration, state paternalism, and imperial benevolence. In my view, he should have added free, compulsory, and secular education to that list, because that principle was crucial to the creation of a distinctively Australian social framework and was self-consciously about universal access to learning and self-consciously about distinguishing Australia from old Europe in a variety of ways. Interestingly, the phrase free, compulsory and secular can be found in Labor Party national platforms nearly 100 years later. such was the power of that concept. The commitment to learning that's embedded in these kind of initiatives, to be frank, came initially from progressive liberals, particularly in Victoria. But it soon became central to Labor's mission. It's interesting that our most famous icon is called the Tree of Knowledge. It's not called the Tree of Public Ownership. It's not the Tree of Labour Market Regulation, nor is it the Tree of Welfare. So even at the very outset, that sense of learning was very deeply embedded in Labor's culture, in our mission. Now, I have to admit that in the first half of the last century, Labor's commitment to learning was probably modest. The first federal political leader to promise federal funding for schools was Sir Robert Menzies in the latter war years when he was trying to rebuild the Liberal Party. John Curtin, then Prime Minister, rejected the idea. Labor didn't commit to that proposition until 1961. And Labor movement attitudes to learning in that time were probably a bit mixed. Many unionists disdained university education as the domain of the spoiled rich. And this attitude I experienced even in the 1970s and 1980s in the Victorian Labor Party, a bit of an ingrained or entrenched antagonism to universities because that's basically where rich people went. However, the trade union movement was also a reflection of a very rich tradition of trade and technical learning, which later culminated in the sweeping reforms of the 1980s inspired by Laurie Carmichael and the ACTU. And the tradition of learning and of pride of craft, pride in craft, pride in technical capability, pride in trade, was very much an important component of militant trade unionism in Australia. Everybody knows the broad story of John Halfpenny, one of the most militant and most notorious and most famous of Australia's trade union leaders. What many people don't know is that John Halfpenny's youth was also Victorian Apprentice of the Year. So there's a deep thread of commitment to craft and to learning in the tradition of militant trade unionism and labourism in this country as well. Since that period of the 50s and 60s, the commitment to learning, I'd argue, has gradually become the core theme in Labor's belief system. The Whitlam government was defined more by its education initiatives, like the Schools Commission and free university tuition, than any other policy. The only contender for that crown other than its education initiatives would, of course, be Medibank. In his 1974 election campaign speech, Whitlam described the Schools Commission as the greatest single achievement of our government. The background work on this policy began as early as 1964. Since then, learning has been right at the heart of Labor's message. If you think about the Hawke-Keating era, think of the massive expansion of university education, the creation of cooperative research centres, the training guarantee levy, the development of competency-based training that I referred to before, the establishment of the Australian National Training Authority, labour market programs under Working Nation with a mutual obligation component inevitably about training and learning, massive increases and improvements in school retention rates, the Clever Country. So many big things happened in the Hawke-Keating era that we tend to overlook the lasting importance of learning as a central thread that runs through the entire period of that government. And since we lost office, it's become even more crucial. Think of Kim Beazley's Knowledge Nation policy, much derided, but in content exactly the kind of thing that this nation required. Mark Latham's Learning and Earning Strategy for Young Australians, Kim Beazley's recent Skills in Schools blueprint, and University's White Paper, which I would argue is probably the most important and substantial piece of serious policy work done on either side of politics in the past decade in this country. Kim Beazley says often that he wants to be Labor's Education Prime Minister. The education and training portfolio is held by our Deputy Leader, Jenny Macklin. Over the past couple of years, we have produced more substantial policy in this area than in any other. Steve Brax, at the state level, describes education as his government's number one priority, and you'll hear similar sentiments expressed in various other parts of the country. Craig Emerson, who's made a name for himself on the backbench as a very vigorous and radical policy thinker, is promoting radical reform proposals that are really built on a single premise, that learning is the key to better social and economic outcomes. And how often have we heard Labor leaders use the phrase education, education, education? Labor's commitment to learning can also be seen locally, and I want to cite a specific example of this that I find personally very inspiring. The city of Hume has established a global learning village in Broadmeadows, which is a very disadvantaged part of the northern suburbs of Melbourne. A major learning hub, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year financing from the local council, the City of Hume, that offers library resources and a whole variety of courses, dozens and dozens of courses for local residents, with assistance from private donors like Visy and Ford and The Age. The village also offers a prize annually to one child in year four in every primary school in the City of Hume. That's 44 primary schools. They offer a computer as a prize that they call a Love of Learning prize. And the whole idea is to promote commitment to learning through this prize. The village funds and operates a Celebration of Learning festival, and its literature states very overtly that it aims to get people, quote, to embrace learning as a way of life. I'm proud of the fact that Labor councillors have been at the forefront of this commitment. Others, like Frank Maguire, also deserve great credit, but former Mayor Gary Jungwirth has played a leading role. His passion for creating learning opportunities in one of Melbourne's most disadvantaged areas, in my mind, makes him a true Labor hero, though people outside of his own backyard would probably not have heard of him. He is somebody who is living out in his commitment in local government what I see as the core ethos that drives Labor. Now, it's important to point out that learning is much wider than education. It's not just a skills issue, it's not just a productivity issue or an economic inputs issue. To me, it's a values issue. Learning increases opportunity, it enables participation, it opens hearts and minds. It is about values as much as it's about economics. It's at the heart of debates about childcare, preschools, schools, universities, TAFE, apprenticeships, obviously, labour market programs, neighbourhood houses, welfare, immigration, aged care even. It helps deliver better social and economic outcomes, better health outcomes, like alleviating loneliness and dementia, or delaying the onset of dementia. The Smith family even defines learning as, and again I quote from a letter to the Financial Review recently, the foundation for helping disadvantaged children to break free from the spiral of poverty. Here's a simple question. If there were no skills crisis, would Labor still be passionately committed to expanding our nation's investment in learning? You bet we would. You bet we would. The passion in that commitment defines the kind of society that we want to create. It reflects our core values, it reflects my core values, not just a prescription for better economic outcomes. Learning is about discovery, it's about building a better world. Now, this commitment to learning now matters more than ever. Why? Because under John Howard, the Liberal Party has gradually morphed into an anti-learning party, seeking to exploit the disdain for learning that is inherent, I think, in the Australian culture. What makes you angry tells you a lot about your personal belief system. Denigration of learning has been a persistent theme in the Howard government's message over the years. And over that past 10 years, I can't think of anything that's made me angrier than the regular undermining of learning values. We're one of the few countries in the world where the term academic is a term of derision. We worship sports people and we ignore intellectual achievers. We revere the practical and the physical, and we barely tolerate the cerebral. Now, in the 1950s and 1960s, that probably didn't matter that much because national development was heavily focused on digging mines, building dams, grazing sheep, and a highly protected and very inefficient manufacturing industry with a lot of basically very low-skilled jobs. Didn't really matter that our levels of education achievement were well below those of similar countries. It sure matters now. I recently reread Donald Horne's famous book, The Lucky Country, and it was very scary because so little has changed. More than four decades later, his basic critique still rings fairly true. Phrases like triumphant mediocrity, cleverness can be considered un-Australian, and a nation more concerned with styles of life than with achievement haven't lost their bite. Now, talking of things that make you angry, a few months ago, Shane Warne, who's a very good cricketer, was awarded an honorary doctorate in business administration, of all things, on his birthday. Happy birthday, Shane, by Southampton Solent University. Now, I think David Beckham's also got a degree from them as well. They're into this kind of thing. And we'll leave the university for another time. But to the Australian media, this was all a bit of a hoot. Warne decked out there with the academic gown and the funny hat and all that kind of stuff. It was a great photo opportunity. It just made me angry. Sure, it was an English university performing this outrageous parody, but the message was really clear. Higher learning is all a bit of a laugh. Funny people in funny hats. Good old fair-dinkum Aussie blokes don't do this sort of stuff, do they? That was the real message of that performance. Now, having somebody like Warne, who's notorious for his lack of interest in learning at school, parading around like some kind of pantomime horse in an academic outfit, to me was very sad. Nobody else really seemed to notice or to care. Now, to me, this nonsense is roughly equivalent to inducting John Howard into the Australian Cricket Hall of Fame for that infamous bowling performance he managed in Kashmir when he dropped the ball on his toe. That's broadly the equivalent. Now, I'm a serious cricket fan, like many other Australians, but I'm also passionate about learning. In fact, I'm more passionate about learning. And when sporting celebrities proudly announce they've never read a book, they're telling young Australians that learning is for nerds. Learning's for nerds. That's the real message. Now, underneath John Howard's glib phrases, what we really have is an unrelenting assault on Australian learning. The party of learning under Menzies has become the party of ignorance under Howard. Few remember that when Howard lost the leadership to Andrew Peacock in 1989, Peacock offered him the shadow Ministry of Education. And he rejected that because it wasn't an important enough portfolio. He hasn't changed. Last year, he observed that leaving school early was fine if you're not academically inclined. His former education minister, Brendan Nelson, constantly sought to inflame resentment against universities amongst non-tertiary educated workers and suggested that creationism ought to be taught in schools. His current education minister claims that Maoists are writing school curriculums, tries to ban serious books on terrorism, and demands that the states should step up to the plate and start contributing to the funding of Australian universities after the Commonwealth under Howard has very dramatically reduced funding to universities. His vocational education and training minister is grinding industry skills councils into the ground. And few will remember this, but I certainly remember it. When I published a book about Australia's future called Open Australia, Peter Costello did one of those famous theatrical performances in Question Time where he quipped that Labor was becoming a book club. Again, underneath this, what do you see? Contempt for learning. It's at the core of the modern Liberal Party. And in an era when education and training are more crucial than ever before, the Howard government's performance on these issues is simply scandalous. Simply scandalous. Our school completion rates are way below OECD averages. In 2005, a staggering 46% of school leavers were not enrolled in any form of post-school education. Our average education levels are significantly below those in comparable countries at all age cohorts. A recent OECD study of 20 developed countries found that we spend the lowest amount on preschool education of any of the 20 countries. Since 1995, this is a famous figure, a well-known figure, Australian government spending on higher education and training, essentially university and TAFE, has fallen by 7%, while the OECD average has increased by 48%. Bob Birrell, not a bloke I always agree with, I'd have to say, nailed this a few weeks ago when he said, far too many young people are not being equipped for a labour market increasingly demanding technical, analytical and managerial skills. This lack of commitment to learning entrenches poverty and disadvantage because early school leavers have much higher unemployment rates and much bleaker prospects in life. Now, juxtaposed against that record is an interesting fiscal record. something in a shadow finance minister I'm very conscious of. Between December last year and May this year, government estimates of revenue for this financial year and the next two financial years were upgraded. A bit more money coming in the door than they thought, to the tune of $42 billion. $42 billion more in government revenue over those 3 years was the estimate in May this year as compared with December last year. Now, they've spent a lot, as you'd expect, either in tax cuts or spending. $42 billion, actually they've spent slightly more, 43 point something. Barely more than 1% of that enormous windfall has been dedicated to additional expenditure in education and training. Barely more than 1%. Slightly higher than has been dedicated to new spending in agriculture, fisheries and forestry. The real message of this is very clear. Ignorance is bliss. That's the real slogan on which the Howard government operates. I want Australia to be a country that values learning above all other things. In John Howard's Australia, it's an afterthought. But, to be fair to him, we shouldn't imagine it's all his fault. It's not. He's simply exploiting and magnifying social prejudice that is deeply ingrained in our culture. Our indifferent attitude to learning isn't just the fault of governments, it's also the fault of parents. Too many Australians regard schools as essentially glorified child-minding centres and don't take much interest in what goes on inside them. Too many are ready to attack teachers and governments for all kinds of failings, but don't take enough responsibility for their kids' commitment to learning. The more contact I have with different schools, the more I'm convinced that the hidden factor in school performance is parental aspiration. Resources are obviously crucial, but attitudes to learning in the family environment are also vital. The passive welfare model of education, which is essentially what we've traditionally had in this country, understates the crucial importance of aspiration. Lack of achievement will often be a product of lack of expectation. If a child grows up in an environment where learning isn't valued, he or she is less likely to succeed in learning and less likely to succeed in life. That's why the Global Learning Village is so important. It seeks to change attitudes to learning in schools, in communities, in families. And that's why Howard's messages are so damaging. If our nation's government doesn't care about learning, why should its citizens? Why should its parents? The she'll be right mentality is an enduring part of our culture, and in certain respects a very positive thing. But part of it is an ingrained hostility to learning. It's fading, thankfully, I have to concede, because parents more and more are starting to realise that skills are crucial to their kids' futures, but it's still strong nevertheless. Young people who want to learn are always more likely to succeed at school and at work. Wouldn't it be great if Australia had a Prime Minister who was dedicated to promoting learning rather than attacking it? To me, commitment to learning is the key to individual and national success. It's being undermined by conservative politicians who are stoking popular prejudice. It's also, I would have to admit, being undermined by things like postmodernist theories. When leading educators argue that learning history is no more important than learning tapestry, something is seriously wrong. The Canberra Times in an article only a couple of weeks ago. If everything's considered equally valid, what's the point of learning anything? Learning doesn't only happen in education institutions. It's not just something that goes on in lecture theatres or laboratories. It's not just for academic types in classrooms. It happens at childcare. It happens in community groups. It happens on the job. Many blue-collar workers lament the demise of serious learning and training in their chosen trades. Talk to a Telstra technician, and you won't have to talk for very long to hear the sad story of the dramatic decline in training and learning within Telstra, the ever-growing outsourcing of skilled activities to people who don't have the same skill levels, and the early stages of what is inevitably going to be a skills crisis in that technical area, along with many others, because of the fact that we've got a huge bulge of people in their late 40s and their 50s who are the primary skilled people. A lot of skilled blue-collar workers have a very strong sense of pride in their craft, in their trade, in learning in their area, and that's why learning is crucial as an underlying value, not just for the kind of learning that I engage in as a young person, but right across the board, be it academic or technical. And our need for skilled technical workers has never been greater, and yet somehow we've managed to alienate countless young people from learning through an excessive focus on university entrance in schools. We've effectively increased the barriers. Labor is thankfully committed to fixing this problem. Kim Beazley's plan for specialist senior technical schools, I think, will make a big difference. In a world where our skills are our best safety net, we cannot afford to push young people away from learning. So in conclusion, we've got, I think, a very big task in front of us. We have to change Australian attitudes to learning. We don't just want to change funding. We don't just want to change curriculum. We don't just want to change structures. We have to change attitudes as well. Let's resolve the endless state-federal disputes, public-private disputes, academic-technical arguments. Let's commit ourselves to greater investment in learning across the board. For Australia to compete in a changing world, we have to become a learning society. Labor's primary goal isn't extending public ownership. There's a statement of the obvious for you. It isn't extending the welfare state. That's a statement of the almost obvious. It's not even extending labour market regulation, notwithstanding the life and death battle that's going on about work choices. Our primary goal is to extend access to learning, to ensure everyone can live full, good lives and participate fully in our society. One of the things that I've worked out over the years is that pretty well everybody's good at something. And part of the trick about running a decent society is to ensure that everybody has got the ability to pursue that thing that they're good at and to be valued for it, to make a contribution to the society. We have to ensure that everybody can turn that ability into a worthwhile contribution and be rewarded for it. Learning changes lives. It's the key to a better future for our kids, and it's a key to the better future for our country. We need more investment in learning. We need a much stronger commitment to the ethos of learning. And most importantly of all, we have to abandon that lingering culture of mediocrity and ignorance. It could be amusing to some. No doubt plenty of people laughed when they saw Shane Warne in his funny outfit. It might be amusing to some, but it's dragging us down. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that. I should say thanks to Minister Ellison for the use of this facility tonight and for the Minister's hospitality. Much appreciated. So we come to question and discussion. We have till 7 o'clock, and if we run out of questions, we've never had this before actually, but I got a question via text message today. It's from a person called Dr. Warning. So if we run out, we've got one here.
His question is, who's Lindsay?
Okay, now we don't have a lot. We've got to be brief with our questions. Yes.
Can you explain what the white paper about universities is that you mentioned, and does Labor have any plans to get back to the good old days when they had enough money to run their operation?
Certainly we do, although the question of how much that amount might ultimately involve is obviously a matter yet to be finally determined, but certainly there's a commitment to increase the funding to universities, as there was has been at previous elections. There's a number of themes in that white paper. One is to move away from the one-size-fits-all highly micro-regulated university and allow a greater internal market within the university sector, so allow a greater freedom for universities to make choices about how they offer, what they offer, how they offer it, so on. I think that's quite an important thing. Secondly, there's a strong recognition that we are under threat on the quality front, and a proposal to establish a quality agency that is there as a reference point. There's been some significant concerns about the tendency for some universities to lower quality in order to maximise their overseas students' input, which is in turn being driven by the funding starvation problem. So that's another proposal in that paper. Thirdly, of course, the need to alleviate the HECS burden, specifically in certain areas where Australia is not attracting as many students as we should, in areas like mathematics and science and some of the technical disciplines. So there's proposals around those issues. There are proposals about funding generally and the approach that should be taken, in which it's implicit that we do increase funding to universities. Now, there's a number of other things in the paper. I can't rattle them all off the top of my head, but it's actually about 100 pages. But it's quite well written, so it's readable. But for those who are specifically interested in higher education policy, I would very strongly urge you to read it and give us feedback on it, because a lot of work, a lot of thought has gone into that paper.
I don't entirely agree with you that the anti-intellectualism and anti-academic feeling is rife in Australia, but how exactly would a government go about changing that sort of attitude if it's entrenched in the culture?
Look, I think what politicians say, particularly prime ministers, is enormously influential, and what they legitimise and what they don't legitimise is enormously influential. That's why, even though strictly speaking, when John Howard says it's fine to leave school early, strictly speaking, what he was saying was it's fine to leave school early and go on to an apprenticeship or a trade and whatever. But in reality, the message that was conveyed was it's fine to leave school early, and for those of you who've done it well, you know, it's no big deal, and so on. So wider messages to the community, I think, matter a lot. And I'm talking from personal experience here. My family were classic inner Melbourne, sort of working class origin, one Protestant, one Catholic couple who moved to the bush. They sort of came into, you know, I was born in the mid-50s, they came into their kind of period of sort of following politics, I suppose, the height of the Menzies era. And they absorbed, like countless other people, a really strong message in the 1950s, and that was education is crucial. Education is crucial. And I don't think there's any doubt that the ultimate source of that sentiment was the Prime Minister, for whatever reason. And we have many gripes with Menzies on many fronts, but from my personal background, my personal experience, I give him credit for setting a tone in public life in the 1950s on this issue that said learning's important. Because my parents absorbed it, and they absorbed it from other sources as well, and I ultimately benefited from that. So I think wider messages are really important. And how often do you hear John Howard actually talking up learning and the value of universities and the value of training, all those things? You don't. Because he's starving them money. You know, I think he understands that he'd look a bit ridiculous. So,
I'll stop you in Victorian working class story. I came up in a similar background, but my Protestant mother that became a Catholic married my Catholic father, and I went off to 2 and 6 a week Catholic school. I agree with you, it was an era of learning and all the rest of it, but that was our only way up. But we've gone through a period now of 30 years of taking university education free, as it once was, for granted. And I just wonder to what extent our public and secular education system and our free university system isn't to some extent responsible for this backlash, or getting back to some more pragmatic utilitarian idea about the worth of whatever you train to do. And it's interesting that while you talk about, you know, the lowest common denominator attitude to learning, we've also got a situation now where there's a sort of two-track education, where we've got private schools becoming more and more popular, and this is not John Howard. And we've got Canberra with the highest percentage of children going to private schools, which is, you know, one of the most Labour-leading electorates. So to what extent do you think we've just had too many decades of taking education in a welfare sense for granted, and that we really need Labour included, a whole new idea about what we mean by education?
Look, I think that's a valid point. And I think one of the things we don't understand is wider social and economic change, so that people often criticise the baby boomers and say, oh, it's fine for you, you know, you had free university education and we don't. Well, yeah, about 10% of them did. Pity about the other 90% who didn't go to university. I was part of a very small group. And, of course, there's been a massive expansion in university education. So in the equivalent cohort now, it's probably about 35-40% going to university. And the crucial thing about private schools, where I think I'd be in agreement with the underlying point, what you're saying, what's more than anything else driven the drift to private schools is affluence. The percentage of the population, with or without government subsidies, who can afford to send their kids to private schools has soared because the relative standard of living of the vast bulk of Australians now compared with 50 years ago is much greater. In real terms, our incomes, our average incomes, are roughly treble what they were 50 years ago. And inevitably what that means is that just as people are buying jet skis and plasma TVs and overseas trips, that a lot of people are actually choosing to invest in their kids' education. Now, is that a bad thing? Of course it's not. Of course it's not. And one of the things that I want to see Labor unhooked from is this kind of internal public versus private debate. We have got a primary responsibility as government to the government education system, but that doesn't mean that we should be denigrating private education. As far as I'm concerned, people who want to spend money on educating their children rather than taking some overseas cruise or putting a swimming pool in the backyard, good on them. If they've got that kind of disposable income, and yes, there's debates about government money and how that should be allocated, and yes, we are firmly committed to the needs principle as the bedrock of how that's done. But don't for a moment denigrate people for sending their kids to private schools. You know, like, if that's ultimately driven more than anything else by affluence. Now, I'm strongly committed to the public school system and building up our investment in that system and improving the system, but to me it doesn't advantage anybody to do that as some kind of public versus private debate. I think we've got to move beyond that.
Question here. Yes, you talked about the, what I might call the duck showing and finger pointing between the federal and state governments over education. Something that needs to be addressed. How will you address it?
In a sense, there's a question still to be answered there, and of course I'm not the person specifically in charge of these policy areas, but I'll tell you one thing that we definitely won't do is the kind of opportunistic cherry-picking style of approach that the Howard government has done, whether it's about flagpoles or about report cards or whatever. The one thing John Howard will never do about schools is take responsibility. He'll never take responsibility. There's all these little interventions that are designed to play a political card and to tweak a populist nerve somewhere in the electorate while always maintaining the ability to blame the states for the wider outcomes. Now, that's one thing I'm certainly not going to get into, and I'm absolutely convinced Jenny Macklin, Kim Beazley are not going to get into. So, yes, there is a question there. I think we will approach that in a sense of cooperation, seeking to establish an intelligent distribution of responsibilities between Commonwealth and states. But, as your question implies, we have yet to set out a specific proposition along those lines, and in some respects, it's not easy to do that from opposition. It's hard to negotiate with sovereign governments, even though they're of the same political colour as us, when you're not a sovereign government yourself, about such fundamental issues.
Chris Drummond.
Lindsay, you mentioned that you brought up in Victoria and you read books. This was prior to TV. Now children have not only TV, pay TV, iPods, laptops,
PSPs.
The issue is, I suppose, the internet. I'm interested in your view on whether the internet as a resource is an opportunity or a threat to learning. There's opportunities for plagiarism, there's opportunities for now. Do you need institutions anymore because you've got online functionality where you can deal directly and get the resource rather than having to attend an institution?
Look, I think ultimately it's a profoundly positive development, but it does have some negative characteristics that, like any new technology, you need to be conscious of and you need to minimise. To me, the best historical parallel with the emergence of the internet is the invention of printing. That's the best parallel that I can think of. So, for example, did printing destroy face-to-face learning? No, it didn't. So did classrooms and tutorials and word-of-mouth based learning disappear as a result of the invention of printing? No, it didn't. What happened was that a new delivery mechanism with vastly greater reach and capability was created, and it added to the existing mechanisms. And I think that's essentially what the internet's doing as well. There are one or two areas that you are right to perhaps have some concern about, but in overall terms, I think it's a profoundly positive thing, and it's a profoundly democratic thing as well. The fact that it's harder for governments to tell you, you know, what to learn, or to tell you that, you know, you're on this topic, you're allowed to look at these things but not those things, I think that's broadly a very positive thing. I think the Wikipedia is fantastic. The idea that you have this kind of constantly evolving, argued about detailed knowledge that people are contributing to on a daily basis, and that people like me can just access about some of the most obscure things imaginable, to me that's fantastic.
You in it?
I suspect I probably am, but I haven't looked.
Well,
maybe I should.
Must have a look.
Yeah. I'd better check. There could be all sorts of horrible things about me.
You need to.
Well, I think the deputy leader was being argued over in the Wikipedia, wasn't she?
Yeah.
To what extent does the policy document extend the love of learning into later life? And you know, is this an area of emphasis to improve the quality of life and longevity as well?
I mentioned this in passing in my speech. I think it's very important. I've had relatives who've been involved in the University of the Third Age, for example. My former headmaster from school, who must be seriously aged by now, but exactly the same as he was, you know, 30-odd years ago, and somebody I respect and admire enormously. When I caught up with him a couple of years ago, he was teaching history courses at a University of the Third Age down in the peninsula. I've got a University of the Third Age that's established in my electorate that I helped to launch. That's a really worthwhile thing. I think the extent to which we assist mature age people to develop new skills and to extend or improve their employability is still very, very modest in this country. I've had an ongoing email exchange with this bloke who has had various work in technical areas of graphic design and various other things for a number of years. He's in his mid-30s. He's got no formal qualifications. He's unemployed. He's actually got a range of genuine skills, and he's desperate to get an adult apprenticeship, but he needs some kind of serious income support because he can't, you know, suddenly go to $7 an hour or whatever it is, and he's really struggling. So there's some really important things I think we need to do in that area. And I think it's been fairly well established that learning, whether it's learning a musical instrument or learning a language or whatever, or just engaging your brain, does actually delay the onset of dementia. Now, that's kind of a pretty serious issue in the modern world. My mother-in-law's got Alzheimer's. I've got two other close relatives with Alzheimer's, and the numbers on the percentage or the raw numbers of people who are going to have dementia as our population ages is quite frightening. So the more we can ward that off, that's a serious objective in social policy.
Okay.
Do you think Dawkins really has established allowed too many universities in Australia? You would have to now go to, say, towards an American system where you have a small number of high-class universities that are very hard, very competitive, very hard to get in with, and the others are the also rats.
Look, I wouldn't necessarily put it that way, but I think the case for the Dawkins model of that uniform, you know, 35 or 38 or whatever it was, institutions all essentially seeking to be pretty much the same thing. I think the critique of that is correct, although the underlying rationale for it was compelling. I wouldn't necessarily describe it in the way you've described it, but I think the theme of Jenny Macklin's university's paper is to allow some internal market forces to produce some differentiation there, to make sure that you've got core funding that enables regionally based universities to survive, but provided that they actually, in a sense, follow the market and don't try to turn themselves into things that realistically they're not going to be. I strongly support the thrust of that, but I think there's some more debate to be had on that question.
Yes, I'm encouraged to feel that you're doing a step up from mere navel-gazing to deeper soul-searching, but yet, was it not a Labor Party that made universities not free anymore? In other words, it started that, and that could possibly have begun the lowering of intellectual quality through the years in between.
The first part of your question, that's certainly true. And I opposed, I was a union secretary at the time, the introduction of HECS. I opposed it. I was wrong. And I've actually admitted that numerous times publicly for quite a number of years now. What I didn't realise, what I didn't understand at the time, was that the choice the Hawke government was making was to massively expand the system and to massively expand the number of young Australians able to undertake higher education, and the price for doing that was to require them to contribute something in the fairest way that was able to be dreamed up to the cost of doing that. So in a sense, they made a choice that said, we no longer need a Rolls-Royce system for a relatively small group of people, as prevailed in the 70s when I was at university. Our society needs a much larger number of people to undertake higher education, but both for fiscal reasons and for equity reasons, they should make a contribution. I opposed it at the time. I'm happy to admit I was wrong. Whether this made whether this has contributed to a denigration of learning or undermining of learning, look, in certain specific small respects, possibly yes. So underfunding of universities and overcrowding and some of the more dubious practices associated with maximising overseas student intakes by some universities, undermining of quality, I suspect on the margins that's probably true and therefore worthy of being addressed. I would say to you that I think Jenny Macklin's paper about universities does actually take those issues into account. The time will tell whether we reverse those trends, but I wouldn't say they're big factors, but I'd concede that, yeah, they are factors.
Final question down the back, yeah.
The term learning, as you've described, it seems to cover both education and research. That seems to me it's much harder to sell funding of research than just funding of education. If you say we don't increase the funding of education by universities, it might be easy to sell, but it's much harder to sell the idea of funding research projects. But from a productivity perspective, we need to increase funding for research as well. How do you overcome that?
Look, that's a fair point. We have, it's an interesting kind of internal discussion within Labor over the years that we have at various times made promises to significantly increase funding for research generally, both universities, CSIRO, research and development tax concession, cooperative research centres. And some would argue that the political flow on from that has been modest and that there's not many people out there voting one way or the other on those issues. I think it's more complicated than that, but I actually think ultimately the thing that matters in politics is a sense in the community that you've got a vision for the future of the nation that you're committed to, you believe in, and that has got some kind of coherence and that is not obviously stupid. That's a very important thing. It's a very important thing. And that even the components of that may not in themselves excite a lot of people can nonetheless be very powerful components of a wider picture. So I think it's probably true to say that by itself a funding commitment to research is not the kind of thing that's going to be front and centre in a big election campaign and that's going to swing hundreds of thousands of votes one way or the other. I think that's probably true. But as a component of a broader picture, I wouldn't necessarily say the same thing. So I'd say it's an important part of a bigger picture without necessarily providing you with a big bang all by itself. And to me, what is most important here is that we are rightly attacking John Howard's vision for the future of Australia, which is essentially work choices. But we have to juxtapose against that our alternative vision for the future of Australia, and I think things like research are a pretty important part of that. But if we allow it to be broken down to the different components and each of them to be judged individually in isolation, then some of them probably won't meet much of a political test, whereas I think collectively, if we get it right, then we'll have an uplifting, positive message that's a practical message about building a better country that will make work choices look the tawdry, unfair, extreme proposition that it is, even more than it already does.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thanks, John.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.